All right.
Well, welcome to the Sunday Night There Is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. We will now introduce our speaker, a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. Please help me welcome Paul G., a compulsive overeater from Southern California. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you so much, Chris. And thanks for Dovale for the connection. It's great to see you face to face here. And thanks for welcoming me. So Paul G., recovered compulsive overeater, absolutely not cured. One day at a time, I get to show up here. So just a little bit of background. I'm 66. My top weight is about 275. Lowest weight was 175, and for a very short period of time, I can guarantee you. I have been in OA two times. I came back to OA in September of 2020. And when I came in, I was about 245 pounds, and I'm about 195 pounds now. My abstinent date is February 1st of 2021. And I've never been below 200 pounds for more than about 15 minutes in my adult life. So, you know, I did do one diet that was medically supervised fast when I was maybe in my mid-30s. And I thought I had arrived, and I, you know, got down to less than 10% body fat, 175 pounds. And what I found out is that I had not arrived. I found out that I really did have a problem. So, you know, what I found out when I came back is that I have a living problem and that I need a living solution. And I have found that living solution in the Big Book. So, you know, currently I'm in my second marriage. I had three children. I have five grandchildren. When I came back, I had type 2 diabetes, hypertension, neuropathy, numbness in my toes, vitiligo, sleep apnea, some other things. And that wasn't what got me back. You know, that wasn't enough. All of those health issues, the fear of losing my toes, that wasn't enough to get me back. And it wasn't enough for me to seek out, you know, a permanent solution to my problem. I thought I was seeking out solutions. So if I take it back, when I was seven or eight, I think is when the symptoms of compulsive overeating started to show up. I started wearing husky size clothes. That was the, you know, the bigger sizes at that time. They had a husky clothes area. I had a pattern of eating comfort foods, watching TV. And the interesting thing about that to me, looking back, is I had no awareness of other members of my family being there. All I had was the awareness of me, my comfort foods, and the TV. And I would go back and forth to the kitchen, you know, the 15, 20 feet that there was, and I was a happy camper. But I had three siblings, and my mom was the stay-at-home mom. I just wasn't present to that. So, you know, I couldn't wait for the bakery truck and the ice cream truck and to those to come around the neighborhood with their sounds and music that they play, with all the different wonderful pastries and candies and ice creams. And I would go up to a local dairy and get candy and, you know, different foods. I recall stealing money to buy food. And certainly in my adult years, I would steal food from my colleagues, you know, I'd go, I managed a large group of people, and I didn't hesitate to go into anyone's personal refrigerator and take food, but just, you know, enough so that they wouldn't know, you know, try and move things back so they didn't quite look the same. But I just didn't think twice about stealing food. If I needed food, I was going to do it. You know, if I ran out of money to go buy it at the vending machines, then I would do my trip around the office, every place that I knew I might be able to find something. But so, you know, as I got older, my first diet was in high school. It was, you know, the first of many. I did lose some weight in the latter part of high school. And when I got into my 30s, I was starting to see, you know, I wasn't as active as I was, and I was putting on the weight. I was in a stressful job, or at least it was stressful for me. And all of my inadequacies were showing up, and I needed something to take care of my fears and my anger and, you know, my resentments and feeling less than. And, you know, and as a kid, I was terrible at sports. And I'm sure it was my lack of confidence. You know, in baseball, they put me in right field and I was scared to death they were going to hit a ball out there. You know, dating, if a girl was interested in me, then I was okay. But I was not going to go up and talk to any girls or introduce myself. You know, in fact, I dated the first woman really that had a serious interest in me. And we ended up getting married, and we were together for 25 to 30 years. So I went on a medically supervised diet, you know, in my probably early 30s. And during a 90-day period, I had 5 shakes a day. I ate maybe a peanut and a half a week then. And once again, you know, I thought I had arrived. I thought, that's it. That's all I need to do. That'll be it. It'll be over. You know, I worked with a nutritionist. They brought me off the plan. I thought, well, this should be fine. But I started to see that there were a lot of things besides the weight that weren't working in my life. Although I was active in a church at the time, you know, having been in, been out, been in, been out. When I was 18, my mom said, okay, you don't have to go. I think when I was 16, she said, you can go to church on your own. So I would just take my car, because I had a car, and drive down to the beach and walk on the pier, watch the surfers for a while, and then go home after church. So my dishonesty was not only in food, but in other areas. But I still thought, you know, I'm a good person. It's not, what's the big deal, right? When we had kids, we got back involved in a local church, and it was the church of my youth. And, you know, I was a Eucharistic minister. I was on the administrative council. I was giving talks from the pulpit and, you know, about sacrificial giving and different things. But I had felt separate and apart from God my entire life. And I didn't quite understand how other people could have this amazing relationship with God, you know, and they talked about it, and, you know, they would fall over when people prayed over them. And, you know, that never happened to me. I just thought people were lying about it. And, you know, I had developed a pattern of, I would appear to be outwardly compliant. You know, I was always to your face, I'm going to be a nice guy. And I really was trying to be a nice guy, but I was willing to be dishonest to protect myself. And I worked hard to get recognition. And, you know, I was a validation seeker. I needed your validation to feel good about me. But it was never enough to fill the God-sized hole that I tried to fill with food, sex, TV, certainly at times alcohol, and when I was younger, pot. And I was definitely a people pleaser, and I was willing to go to any lengths, you know, to protect my image in your eyes. And you know, I just, I was a great actor. That's what it was. You know, I could act. I could act the part of being, you know, Paul, the great guy, right? And, but in my mind, I was Paul the loser and Paul the a-hole, you know, and Paul the, you know, the father that wasn't enough, the husband that wasn't enough, the man that wasn't enough, the man that was weak-willed and, you know, just praying that people wouldn't find out what a loser that I was, because I was an upstanding person. I thought, well, what if they find out that I eat this way, that I think this way, that I act this way? And, you know, I would often, I'd say yes to do something and then I wouldn't do it. And I really wouldn't know why am I not doing it? You know, I was in a service club and a guy asked me once and he says, oh, you're one of those people that says yes and means no. And I didn't really know that I meant no, but I was saying yes to please when I probably couldn't deliver on what he was asking me to do. So, you know, I was having problems at work. I was having problems in my family. My kids were walking around eggshells with me. And that's exactly what I hadn't wanted to be, because that's the way I was with my father. My father was a disciplinarian. When he would get home, I didn't want to be around him. You know, I would rather be outside and gone. My mom suffered from postpartum depression, not only when I was born, she was hospitalized, but also when my younger brother was born 5 or 6 years after that. And I didn't even remember, or I didn't know that that was part of my background until I had, you know, a cousin share that with me. So, you know, those things I'm sure affected me. But it was really that things weren't working in my life that I went back. I went to a counselor, a therapist, and my first Ebby was a hairstylist. And, you know, she shared the name of a counselor. I went, and it just so happened it was a 12-step counselor. And she said, okay, we'll go to this meeting, go to that meeting, go to this meeting. We'll try and determine what your issues are. And I pretty much ended up in OA. And I really gave it the college try. You know, it was great. I discovered spirituality rather than dogma. You know, one of the counselors I had suggested to me to get rid of the judge in my head. I might draw a picture of it and stick it in the freezer. But in truth, it was really about thawing out this rigid personality that was driven by my internal expectations of myself and you, that were always running the show with the underpinning of fear that you're going to find out that I'm worthless, fear that you're going to find out that I'm not enough, fear that I'm going to fail. Oh my God, what if I fail? You know, what if I can't meet this perfect picture of myself that I will never attain, that I was always holding myself up to? So, you know, I stopped. I set aside alcohol. I set aside anything. I picked my binge foods. I got a sponsor. I started to work the steps. And after a while, I was even sponsoring. I had some good physical recovery. But I never really got above step 8 and 9. And so the problems that I had, the food was down, but I still had the emotional problems. I was still reactive, like, you know, I'll get out. With all of these expectations. And I really never got above step 8 and 9. I didn't ever get into a step 10, which today, steps 10, 11, and 12 is how I live. That's the design for living for me. You know, the first 9 steps are the recovery steps, but 10, 11, and 12 for me is the design for living. And it's how I have to live my life, like no fooling. And, you know, I learned a lot that first stint in OA. Depression showed up. I started taking antidepressants. You know, they helped somewhat, but it really wasn't doing the trick. I kind of gave program and I was doing individual therapy, group therapy, expressive art therapy. I was writing poetry, reading poetry. I did men's group work. Over the years, I did many more different things. And they all gave me a great toolbox for communication and growth. None of them addressed the hole in my soul and compulsive overeating and my alcoholic personality, which, you know, I didn't have a clue how to fix. Well, one, I thought I had to fix myself. Come to find out, I don't need to fix myself. I just need a living solution is all. So it got to where I checked into a mental health unit for 10 days because I had suicidal ideas. I wasn't happy in my marriage. I came out, and shortly after that, I ended up getting divorced. My partners fired me. You know, I wasn't, one of my partners said, Paul, sometimes you're really great. You know, you're just spot on. And sometimes it's like, you don't know which way to wipe. And that was like my disease, right? When I was in fear and I was trying to hide my mistakes or afraid I would make a mistake, afraid about something I'd done or that I needed to get done. God, I would procrastinate and I would hide it. You know, if it was a tax notice for a client, I would hide it. Just like it's going to go away. You know, I often think of my mind, it was like a lazy Susan, right? That the bad stuff, if it was at the back of the lazy Susan, you know, like under the cupboard in the back, I didn't even ever think about it. But then when it would get around to the front of the lazy Susan, it's like, oh my God, there it is again. And it would be so painful. You know, of course I would have to eat to get rid of the pain of how I was so out of touch with, you know, those internal values of who I wanted to be, but I couldn't achieve it. So I ended up leaving OA in the midst of being fired by my partners and getting a divorce and moving out of my family home, which was just really, I mean, it was pretty tough to not be with my kids and go through that. But I ended up getting a job in government and was commuting. And I did that work for the next 20, 23 years and recently retired. But you know, all of that stuff was there and I just didn't associate it with my weight. Even after being in OA, I didn't really get that food was the solution to my problems. It wasn't my problem. And when I came back to, you know, I want to talk about the progressive nature of the disease too. When I was in OA the first time, yeah, it was about weight and it was about health, but I didn't have type 2 diabetes. I didn't have hypertension. You know, I didn't have, as far as I know, I didn't have leaky gut or an autoimmune disease called vitiligo, or I'm sure I snored, but I didn't have sleep apnea. But I didn't connect those with the alcoholic behavior. You know, and it's like when you look at pages 60 through 63 in the big book, and it talks about me, it's like they wrote the big book in the 1930s and they wrote it about me. How the hell did they do that? I don't know how they did that. But, you know, that's me in that book. And I was shocked to see myself in there and to find out that I'm not the only one. So, you know, I there were aspects of my life that were getting better. You know, I was causing less chaos in my life, but I was still hiding my mistakes. I was still dishonest. I was still stealing food. And the disease was progressive. And oh, come to find out that it's permanent. And by the way, it's fatal. So, you know, I have a disease. I'm bodily and mentally different. And that's what I found out when I came back. But before that, I just thought I needed a good diet and some discipline. So I was able to get into another long-term relationship. We got married in 2018. And in 2019, I discovered intermittent fasting. And I thought, oh my gosh, here it is. I have arrived at last, you know, and I was under 200 pounds, probably for 15 minutes. And I just thought I can do this the rest of my life. Well, I really couldn't. And within probably a month or two after losing 50 pounds, I was starting to put the weight back on. But then three things happened in my life that just threw me a curveball. And I think they, for many of us, you had the same. So one, COVID was March of 2020, right? It's like I'm in my house every day. My wife is now in my house every day. And I retired April 1st of 2020. And so I'm in my house and I'm not working every day. What am I going to do? I'm going to watch Netflix. You know, I really didn't, I wasn't active. And I guess I was doing some walking. But the biggest thing that really threw me for a loop is that February 19th of 2020, we couldn't reach my 41-year-old son. He lives on his own. And I went over to his apartment and found him dead. And, I was pretty pissed at God. You know, I blamed God, you know, and I didn't understand, God, why have you taken my son? I mean, I had a God of my misunderstanding, right? And it was the judgmental God that sat up in the clouds, the bearded guy that I would send arrow prayers to that I never felt connected to. But then he totally screwed me, you know? And as far as I was concerned, I didn't understand why he would do that to my son's three kids. You know, why would he do that to his mother had already passed and he had already suffered that loss, right? My other two kids had suffered that loss too. And now him, you know, so his kids don't have a dad. I don't have a son. His two siblings don't have, you know, a brother anymore. And my youngest son, it was like that was his best friend. So what the hell's going on? What's the point in this, right? I don't understand. So, I was desperate for a connection to a power greater than myself that I call God. And I was open to it being some type of being, you know, whatever. I thought, well, maybe there's a God that created the universe, whatever. I just don't understand the rest. And as I worked the steps, my sponsor invited me to come up with a conception of my own God. And I wrote down, you know, what is the God of what kind of a God do I, what do I need God to be? And what don't I need God to be? And I created a new understanding. And thank you. And the, I got to look at, well, that God of my misunderstanding, I just needed to fire him. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't meeting my needs. And I was desperate to find a new power that could restore me to sanity, right? And so I was able to come up with a God of my not understanding. I don't understand God. I will never understand God. That's not the point. All I need is that certainly in respect to program, that God has sufficient power to restore me to sanity, to give me one day at a time recovery from this disease. That's the main thing. Now, I ask a lot of other things, and I seek direction, and I do the 11th step every day. But that's the biggest thing. You know, that's what the 12-step programs, I think, bring us. That God of misunderstanding still hangs around and tries to get work sometimes. And I just have to say, no, I don't understand God, but I know that I can rely on a power greater than myself that I happen to call God. And I don't try and describe it, you know, or put it into the context of any dogma or, you know, to religion, but that's just, you know, that's my higher power. And as I worked the steps, I started to see things about myself that I thought I knew, but I never really did know. You know, early on when I was working the steps, I heard someone say, well, test God, test your higher power. and see if you can find him lacking. And I had a behavior that had been a lifetime behavior that was a problem for me. And I asked God to remove that behavior, and God took it away. And I thought, oh, wait a second, this could be something, you know? And when I came in, I was abstinent for like 90 days, right? And it wasn't until 90 days in that I had kind of gone to a screeching halt in answering questions in the OA workbook, the 12 and 12, which is great, but I wasn't getting anywhere. I had a laissez-faire sponsor who said, yeah, you know, I don't give you guys assignments. He'd been here 40 years, and I don't give you guys assignments because you don't do them. So it's like, well, that's perfect for me, right? You know, I'll do it at my own pace, which I stopped. And I heard someone in a meeting say, well, you know, why don't you, she said, I sponsor using the big book, you know, over like 1 to 2 months. I called her and I started working the steps a day before December 25th, 2020. Within 30 days, I'd worked the steps. And a week after that, I went out and I picked up one of my alcoholic foods, you know, because I had an ambiguity about one of my alcoholic foods. And I said, well, it's okay if there's a little bit in there, you know, and I went out and ordered some food. And I said, well, it's okay if there's a little bit in there, I can eat it. And I ate every single bite of it. You know, it was the first thing that came. It was cowboy beans and it had sugar in it. And within minutes, I felt the sugar explode. And I went back and called my sponsor and he said, yeah, I think we're going to say you broke your abstinence. Worked my steps in 3 weeks and I've been sponsoring an abstinence since then. I used different food plans along the way. After I went out that one time, I was willing to get a food plan from a nutritionist. And I thought nutritionists were full of hooey. I thought they were always behind the curve. They didn't know. They weren't doing the newest, best things, you know, and that's what I was doing. I was always looking for the newest, best thing, the magic pill. And the nutritionists didn't know their cheeks from the hole in the ground, you know. But I was willing to turn it over. I was willing to turn it over, everything over to a nutritionist, turn it over to God. And, you know, what I saw when I had gone out is that, you know, I'd heard that very often at step 2 and 10 that people will go out when they're not doing that. And it certainly was steps 2 and 10. I was afraid to do step 10s. And I was afraid of that. My character defect of looking good, right? I don't want to look bad. I don't want to do it wrong. So let's just not do it, right? And I wasn't aware of my character defects until I really started doing step 10. So if I go back to working the steps, I got a huge, you know, eye-opening with step 2 and step 3. When I did my inventory on step 4, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. Column 4 was ridiculous. I had no idea what my character defects were and how I got the ball rolling. You know, I just said selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or selfish, dishonest. I didn't know. And like I said, until I started doing step 10s and got some feedback from my sponsor in step 5, I didn't see him. I didn't know. When I did my step 5 with him, one of the big things he said, I had listed a fear of whatever. I don't remember the fear. And he says, well, you left out dishonesty in the fourth column. And I said, what do you mean? I mean, I'm afraid. What is there? He says, well, you have a dishonest picture of yourself. You have this fantasy of who you are, Paul the loser. Paul the asshole. Thank you. And that dishonest picture is running the show. And it's based on fear. Fear that you're going to find out that that's who I am. Fear that that's who I really am. Because I had a mental image, that picture. It's a fantasy, right? And when I do 10 steps, I see that that's what's running the show. That dishonest picture of me. Paul, you're not enough. Paul, you're not going to get enough. Paul, you're going to get embarrassed. Oh, you can't get embarrassed. I'm always managing my image. So the steps give me something that I never had in my life. One is a relationship with the power greater than myself that I call God, that I've wanted my entire life, that I got by working the steps. So, you know, when I look at that, I thought, okay, that's pretty good, you know. And then I now have a design for living that by living in steps 10, 11, and giving it away in 12, I love sponsoring, you know. I don't know whether I'm a good sponsor, bad sponsor, or a different sponsor, but I love to pass on what was given to me. And in doing that, I see more about me and my character defects. And the biggest thing for me is that when I look at these last few years, you know, from February 19th of 2020 until now, God was, in my mind, God was able to take the most terribly traumatic event in my life and turn it to where, not that it was a trade, right? But that I now have a way of living that I was never able to get to before. I now have a connection with God that I was never able to have before. And yes, I do have to maintain it. And yes, I do have to do the work. And yes, I do have to live in 10 and 11 and 12 and continue to expand my spiritual fitness and not just maintain, right? Because the disease is progressive. And I've got to continue doing more in my recovery today than I did yesterday. And that doesn't count. That's not intuitive to me. You know, what's intuitive is, oh, I did a lot of work yesterday. Let's rest on our laurels. But the book tells me I can't do that. So everything I need to know about recovery is in that big book. My sponsors told me when I'm going to sponsor, the big book does the heavy lifting. The big book and someone's higher power does the heavy lifting. And I've seen that over and over and over in sponsoring. I'll have a guy that's on just, he's totally hopeless on day one. And I may give him an assignment or say, you know, just go out there and be totally in service. And he comes back the next day and he's had a spiritual awakening. It had nothing to do with me, I could tell you, you know. And I see their higher power working in their lives. And I'll close with this. My youngest son, my oldest son died of type 1 diabetes complications. My youngest son has it too. And it scares me. You know, I've had to do 10 steps on that. But he now has 110 days of recovery in the beverage program. And he's living a different life. And he's dealing with grief from the loss of his mother, you know, almost 10 years ago, and the loss of his brother, the loss of a fiance 3 or 4 months ago, and putting down, you know, substances. And as he's seeing a higher power in his life. And can I take credit for that? No, you know, but I know that for many of us, the only big book that our families are going to read is us. So by living the principles of this program day to day, imperfectly, you know, I will never rise above the level of being a human being. And thank goodness for that. You know, embracing being a human is probably the thing that I am most grateful for. And this program gave me that. So with that, I'll pass. Thank you.